Support for Radio Boston comes from Hadestown at the Box Center Wang Theater, Broadway's Tony and Grammy-winning Best Musical, an epic celebration of music, togetherness, and hope, raves Forbes. Playing April 23rd through April 28th. Buy your tickets today at boxcenter.org.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we start today on Capitol Hill. The 118th Congress is up and running, and it's the most diverse representation yet. It's also divided, with the state's entire Democratic House delegation now in the minority, despite Democrats holding the Senate and the White House. Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley of the 7th Congressional District was the Commonwealth's first Black woman elected to Congress in 2018, and she's been pushing Massachusetts' priorities and boundaries since. She joins us now to talk about this divided Congress and several important news items of the day. Congresswoman, welcome back and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year, Tiziana. Good to be with you.
So lots of important things on the mind today. Lots to talk about. Pretty soon, our attention is all going to turn to the weather because it's going to get nasty around here tomorrow. A lot of snow and slush. But we've had very little snow, Congresswoman, and I love it. I'm wondering, are you a snow person? Are you missing the snow, rooting for 4 inches tomorrow, or is it just fine with you?
I'm somewhere in the middle. You know, I lean towards cold weather, you know, just in full transparency, Tiziana, because I like winter fashion, you know, so I like boots and gloves and black and, you know, all those things. But, you know, shoveling, you know, it's some good exercise, but it is an exertion. But, you know, our 14-year-old still loves the snow. So that's a good thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think if you've got kids, you got to be rooting for it for them.
Yeah.
That's right. Okay. Well, we will see what happens tomorrow. In the meantime, there's a lot happening today. I want to talk about the Congress, but I've got a couple of news of the day questions for you. Okay. The Boston Globe revealing yesterday afternoon that Boston Mayor Michelle Wu is floating a proposal on rent control, which we knew she was going to do. She said she'd have a proposal out this year. Looks like it's currently considering capping rent increases at up to 10% every year. I'm aware of how much of your district is in the city of Boston. So any reactions to this initial proposal, which has been confirmed by the Wu administration?
Well, I've long been a proponent of rent stabilization. Again, I represent one of the most marginalized and unequal districts, and that's true across all outcomes and data points. And that's true when it comes to affordable housing. We know that housing is a critical determinant of health. And because of my longstanding advocacy and work in the public health space, I've always been an advocate for housing that is affordable and safe and clean. And moreover, it's an incredible time to be alive, to call the city of Boston, to call this Commonwealth home. And we want to retain the diversity of our neighborhoods, which have made this city so great and have made so many contributions. And so we have to address the impacts of gentrification and displacement. We have to address the impacts of the work of still recovering from a pandemic-induced recession, rising costs, and stagnant wages. So for all those reasons, I've been supportive of that policy.
And I'll just note for our listeners that Boston Mayor Michelle Wu will be with us at Radio Boston on Monday, and we'll ask her that question directly as well. So next topic, as we just hit a few items of news of the day, Congresswoman Pressley, this morning the U.S. reached its debt limit. That's known as the debt ceiling. Secretary of the Treasury Janet Yellen has said she can exercise extraordinary measures sometime into June, and then we will be at a point of crisis. We know that especially more hardline Republicans have said we will not increase the debt limit without serious concessions around budget cuts, for example. Where are you on this subject in this moment, and what do you anticipate is going to play out, let's say, in the next week on this subject?
Well, I won't make any predictions, but, you know, certainly I agree with the Biden administration on this. This has always been a procedural vote. I think the Republicans continue to offer more of the same. They don't really have an agenda that is aligned with the needs of the American people. They want to cut Social Security and cut Medicare and other safety net pardon me, programs. And these things are not up for negotiation. And that's not because I say that. It's because the American people make plain daily how important this is. And so, you know, look, the government, we've got to pay our bills, and we need to be true to our practices. And in the past, this has just been a procedural vote. So
in a standoff more than a decade ago between Congress and the Obama administration, there were real impacts on things like the stock market, credit rating, et cetera, even before, right, even just in the reality of a standoff. And I wonder if there's anything unique to Massachusetts or any specific concerns you have about Massachusetts and our finances here if we wind up in a standoff that even just scares the financial markets, Congresswoman.
You know, again, I don't want to get too far down the road here. Tiziana, again, I think this has always been a procedural vote. We should move accordingly and not negotiate on those things that are essential for all the reasons that I've enumerated and you did just there. And it's because of the fragility and these consequential times that we find ourselves in, why I look forward to the next 2 years of making the affirmative case for why Democrats need get that gavel back and be in the majority, because we are centering the American people. We are we govern with compassion and not contempt or callousness, nor do we govern with chaos, which is what this 118th Congress, how the Republicans came out the gate with this speakership battle and then advanced a rules package with three anti-choice, anti-healthcare bills, and also anti-worker policies, you know, efforts to stop congressional staff from unionizing, gutting the Office of Congressional Ethics. And again, they want to cut Social Security, Medicare, and those critical safety net programs. So this how we started the 118th Congress, I think, has been a sobering look into what we can expect for the next 2 years. The good news is I'm battle tested, and I'm ready to do the work of harm mitigation while also working earnestly and creatively and diligently with the White House and also with the corner office here in Massachusetts to ensure that we are meeting the needs of the people who have entrusted us with this responsibility.
So let's stay in this space between the 118th Congress and being battle tested as a woman who broke ground here in the Commonwealth with your representation even. You know, Pew Research Center calling this the most diverse House and Senate yet. Women make up 153 of the 500 voting and non-voting members. 133 members identify as Black, Hispanic, Asian American, American Indian, or Alaska Native. I do want to note, Pew also says 80% of the people who identify among those categories as people of color are Democrats in Congress. 20% are Republicans. Republicans are in charge. You've just laid out some real frustration at the start of this Congress with the positions that Republicans are taking. You have brought an agenda that you have been very clear as representative of the diverse constituency that you represent. I'm also mindful that we've got a completely Democratic delegation who has been in power for the last several years and is not now. When you talk with other members of the delegation, when you think about your priorities, where are you concerned that this change in power in the House affects what Massachusetts specifically needs?
Well, first, I just want to affirm the progress, the ways in which this is an indicator of progress and the commitment by the Democratic Party and our caucus that we do have historic and diverse, unprecedented representation in our Democratic leadership and also in this Democratic caucus. And I think for those reasons, we are better to more effectively center the needs of the people because a more representative government always more effectively meets the needs of a representative citizenry. Again, that being said, if how you start is how you'll finish, how the 118th Congress started under a Republican majority, chaotic, and I think really underscoring their inability to govern, to lead in this moment with effectiveness, with a real policy agenda. I think what they have proven time and time again is that they have more contempt for the American people, while the Democrats have proved that we have compassion for the American people, and we're centering those things that matter most to them. So I'm going to continue to, I'm only that much more emboldened, Tiziana. I don't have the time to be cynical or apathetic or even to be worried. We are still doing the work of ensuring that we have an equitable and robust recovery from this pandemic. We still very much need to address our affordable housing crisis, have to continue to fight for those investments in multimodal and public transit, because that supports all our other goals, our climate goals, our housing goals, our racial and economic justice goals. I am not giving up fighting for paid leave or universal child care or home and community-based services for the disabled and elderly, or a host of other investments that I hear from my constituents each and every day are issues of consequence to them. And so we do still have the White House, and I've worked very closely with them as the chair of the Abortion Rights and Access Task Force and as an original co-sponsor of the Women's Health Protection Act, which would codify Roe on the federal level. That bill has passed the House twice. To ensure that we're doing everything possible to ensure access to healthcare, and abortion care is healthcare, and ballots throughout the country. We saw states affirm that this is important to them as well. And I want to applaud the FDA for heeding our calls to make available medication abortion at our local pharmacies. So I'll continue to work on issues like that with the White House and also with the Healy Driscoll administration. I was a lead negotiator in the student debt cancellation, and certainly we want to make sure that we're making good on that promise, and we'll see what the courts do. But again, Republicans are playing politics with people's lives, and while they are playing with people's lives, Democrats continue to change and save people's lives. And so that's the work I'll be focused on in partnership with my colleagues, but with this Democratic White House, and also with my corner office here in the Commonwealth.
So a couple of other things I want to get to. You have limited time, I know, and so do we. We've got a couple of minutes left. I do want to come back home. We've been talking about representation. I am thinking about the conversation this week on the embrace. You gave an impassioned speech last week at the unveiling. I know you're aware of criticisms across the country in both white and black communities about that statue. Some people love it. Some people see it as obscene. Some people are frustrated that it doesn't fully represent the visages and presence of Martin Luther King Jr. and Coretta Scott King. I know you've been in a lot of rooms on this. Do you have a reaction to the criticism?
The Embrace Memorial is a powerful tribute to the love of Martin and Coretta and their legacy and a changing Boston. And I'm not going to give oxygen to any bad faith criticism of it by people. I think it's important that we embrace the social justice and civil rights movement that was initiated and led by Dr. King and Coretta. And I take great pride in the fact that their love was forged here in this district and ultimately birthed a movement, one that we are still very much in. And I think my very election and that of Andrea Campbell and so many others is evidence of that progress. But also there's much more work that remains to be done. What we need to embrace is not just the power of symbolism, but also the necessity of systemic change and impact. And that's the work I'm going to be focused on every day. You know, this is, it's important that if we really want to change the narrative of Boston and our Commonwealth writ large, that we change these outcomes, that we close these inequities and disparities and injustices across all outcomes, from economic justice to healthcare and transit access to education equity. And that's the work that I remain squarely focused on.
Last question for you. On the healthcare front, you joined with Congresswomen Lori Trahan, Catherine Clark, and Senator Elizabeth Warren a letter last week to Johnson & Johnson asking for specific information, raising concerns and accountability about the lack of access to children's Tylenol, children's Motrin. Your office says you're expecting or you've asked for a response from them by tomorrow. Do you think you'll get one? And what else can you do to help with this shortage, Congresswoman?
Well, the shortage of infant and children's Tylenol and Motrin in Massachusetts and across the country is unacceptable. It's unconscionable. This is a status quo that can't stand. We're in the midst of a challenging cold and flu season. Parents with sick children visiting store after store being met with empty shelves. And so this was an effort initiated by my office. We led this letter, and Senator Warren, Congresswoman Trahan, and Whip Clark joined us. And I am grateful for the prompt response by Johnson & Johnson, but still unsatisfied. I think we're making progress, but there's still more road to walk here. And we're going to continue to demand answers and do everything we can to address these shortages.
Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley of the 7th Congressional District, Happy New Year to you. I hope we'll get to talk to you again soon.
All right. Thank you.
Let's talk about access to college.
I have been told by adults in my life that college is not for me. I am determined to graduate college.
That is from a 2019 convocation speech by Armando Martinez, a graduate from Salem State University, laying out a problem Salem State has set out to solve starting in high school. According to the Education Advisory Board, former name, now it's the EAB, 33% of first-generation students, or those whose parents didn't attend college, drop out within 3 years. Massachusetts General Hospital's Clay Center for Young Healthy Minds lists some of the obstacles that first-generation college students face: anxiety about academic achievement, social inclusion, money, confusion about navigating life on campus. Well, Salem State's been working on a solution to get first-generation potential college students up to speed in high school so that they hit the ground running with credits under their belt and experience when they actually get to college. It's called the Fortin Scholars Early College Program. Anna Luna is in the studio, too, here with us. She is a student at Salem State who went through the early college program while she attended Salem High School. Anna, welcome.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Has it been worth it? Now that you're at college, taking some college classes in high school, has it paid off the way you wanted it to?
Yes, it has. I went into college already having credits, already knowing what a college class was set up like. So I knew kind of like how the syllabus works, how like the dynamic of the classroom. So it's definitely helped me. And I actually went into college with six to nine credits. And it was nice. I didn't have to take those general education courses over at Salem State.
So were there basically sort of like what we would call prereqs or prerequisites
exactly
that you got done in high school so you could move on to stuff you, and what are you focusing on? What did you move on to?
I'm a criminal justice major, so I actually got to take Criminal Justice 101. I just got to take classes that I wouldn't have been able to take until like my sophomore year or my second semester freshman.
It saves money, saves time,
exactly,
and allows you to focus.
Yes.
So anyone who goes into college, or almost anyone, is afraid, right? There are a lot of unknowns. It's a big new world. You're stepping out as a young adult. If there's no one to tell you what to expect, one can be even more afraid.
Yeah.
How did having so much knowledge under your belt, as well as credits under your belt, help you be more successful, feel more comfortable, be more confident, and stay in the game?
Yeah, so I feel like for anyone, the unknown is scary. So knowing and being knowledgeable and just having all that information can really, really help set up for success. So like I went in knowing what a college class was going to be like. I went in knowing what a professor was going to be like, you know, and I went in with college credits. So, you know, like what's better than that? And at no cost as well during high school. So it was just kind of a win-win.
Are you worried about paying for college?
I was very worried. You know, I'm a first-generation student, first one, you know, in my family to go to college. We didn't know anything about college, didn't even know about financial aid. So I was scared. But, you know, having help and support really did kind of, you know, yeah, I don't know. it just helped. You know, I was able to, like, go into Salem State knowing I would be fine paying my bill, you know.
Your family must be pretty proud of you.
Yes, I hope so.
And are you proud of yourself?
I am. I'm going to graduate in May, so.
That's exciting.
Yes, I'm excited.
All right, so let's bring in two additional voices. Stay with us, Ana Luna. I'm going to bring in Ami Capodanno, who is early college coordinator at Salem High School, and Michelle Pierce, who is the Salem State University Associate Dean in the College of Arts and Sciences and oversees the early college program. Ami, I mean, you steward high school students. What do you find yourself thinking when you hear Ana's story?
I think she is an amazing example of exactly what we are looking for students to have an opportunity to take these college classes, to be able to have the support of of your high school and what you would typically get in a high school while you're taking these college classes, so that you feel it's a little bit of a lower risk at that sense, because you are getting that academic support from a typical high school as well, but still getting that college level rigor and knowing what they are going to expect when they walk onto a college campus makes that experience that much more valuable to them, because they will persist longer while they're on the college campuses, and that's what the data says.
And are students at Salem High School scrambling for this? Do you have to actively recruit? Are they coming to you? Tell me what that's like.
We're in the process of expanding. So when Ana was at our school, it was a juniors and seniors, and now we've actually gone down to the 10th grade. And so we are getting the word out, and we went from offering 12 credits to now potentially 30 credits.
Which is basically a year.
Right, exactly. It's so great. So we are actively recruiting students constantly. And so the school counselors are a critical component to this, to, you know, telling students about it. I'm doing information sessions. We're telling families about it. So we're getting the word out as much as we possibly can to let families know that this is an opportunity for students. If they're ready and they have that curiosity that they think that they can go through this, this is what we want for them.
So let's bring in Salem State University now. Michelle, you're the associate dean there. There's a piece of me that thinks you might just kind of at this point want to take your mic and just drop it, right? Walk out of the room based on what we're just talking about. It feels like Ana and Ami are telling us what must be the point for you.
Yes. So they've done a great job at explaining why we do this. Salem State was one of the first colleges or universities to get the state's designation for early college in 2018. We're very proud of this program. The fact that we can make college more affordable by giving students the opportunity to get the credits in high school. And then also, you know, what Ana highlighted, what the students gain with confidence in being able to succeed in, you know, in college courses while they still have the supports. We think of it as a kind of scaffolding or college with training wheels, in a sense, where they start out having some additional help. And then in our model, they are at the high school in 10th and 11th grade with Salem State faculty going to the high school, working with the high school teacher. And then in senior year, we transport them to the campus, so they do get the campus experience as well.
So you get familiar, yes, Ana, with physically what it's like to be there.
Yeah, so like Michelle said, it did start 2018. So that I was a senior then. So the Salem State professors were going to Salem High, which I loved because, like they were saying, I also was in a familiar environment in a classroom in my high school with a familiar teacher. So it really did help.
Would it have been helpful had you been able to do it multiple years, which is Ami just told us now students there can, to have spent some time on the campus and get that sense? When I was on faculty at Boston College, one of the things they talked about is how important it was that incoming students feel like they belong there.
Yeah.
So talk about that a little
yeah,
bit.
Yeah, I feel if I had the opportunity to start it earlier and possibly like go on campus and get that kind of college campus feel, it would have been great. I feel like it would have made me more excited to go to college. And yeah, I mean, even now, you know, being at school, I'm involved on campus. So it really creates a sense of community.
So let's just reorient listeners. We've got a student at Salem State, Anna Luna, who went through the early college program at Salem High School. We've got Ami Capodanno, who's the early college coordinator at Salem High School. And we've got Michelle Pierce, who's at Salem State and oversees this early college program. Currently, Massachusetts has 21 public colleges and universities who have these. Salem State was one of the first. All right, so I want to talk money for a minute. So Ami, Michelle, when one hears this, okay, you're more likely to go. You feel more comfortable. You get some of the prereqs out of the way. It makes a smoother transition. Of course, it seems like we should just do this. Michelle, how many students have actually come through?
So we have about 150 students who have come through from Salem High. Salem State also has a partnership with Lynn Classical and Lynn English High Schools. Mm-hmm. So we have that started a little bit later. So we have similar numbers coming through.
And how hard is that to fund? Because Anna, as you said, you didn't pay for this.
No.
So how hard is it to fund that? Could you get 1,000 students? What would it take?
We would be limited somewhat. So we do get reimbursement per student enrollment from the Department of Higher Education.
So it's coming from the state.
It is coming from the state. That enables us to staff the courses and offer supports. To be honest, in order to expand, we would need more funding. And that's always, you know, up for discussion, and we're always advocating for that.
Let's hear why Ami laughed.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Say a little more about that.
So I feel like for a four-year institution, they are, I can only assume that the costs that they are putting in and is probably about even for what they are offering and the supports they offer for our students. It is definitely something that I appreciate. They've been such a wonderful partner to us, and I recognize that it can't be cheap.
We're talking about anywhere maybe it's $10,000. So for example, $13,986 is the average cost of tuition at a 4-year public university in Massachusetts. So when Anna maybe has half of the first year classes, that's big savings and it's big cost. Do you have good champions, Michelle and Ami, in the legislature, in the departments? Do you see this growing? Do we have the will in the state to do it?
I think we do. And I should mention that we're very connected to an organization called the Mass Alliance for Early College. And fortunately, they have put a lot of effort into advocating for early college, and that's very helpful to us. It's hard for us, I think, in our day-to-day jobs trying to oversee things to do a lot of that advocacy work.
So that's Michelle at Salem State, Ami at Salem High School. Mm-hmm. What else needs to be done?
So I feel it's a matter of the state does recognize that we require the funding, transportation, mm-hmm. food. There are things that aren't the additionals that you need that you don't really think about for students. And so, while kids are on campus, having food for books and for the busing, I think that's critical. And that funding does go towards that and making sure that students have that access to getting on campus.
So, Anna, Luna, I'll come back to you in your last year at Salem State now. You've said a lot of positive things. You clearly have wisdom and constructive criticism as well. One piece of advice that you would give to the high school and the college going forward. Is there any piece of advice you'd give?
Like in terms of the program?
Yeah.
I don't think I have any. I think the program works and it does what it needs to do. It helps students. You know what I mean? I feel like we should encourage students more to try this program out because, if a student doesn't know if they want to go to college, they can take these classes at no cost and see what it's like. You know what I mean? So I feel like, maybe just putting more supports out there for students, like really, really just putting the program out there.
And what would you say to students who might be listening?
I say try it out, They're not going to lose out on anything. It's saving your time. You're saving money. And if after high school, if they feel like they don't want to go to college, they at least have that experience of taking a college class. They know what it's like.
Anna Luna is a student at Salem State University. Anna, thanks for sharing your story with
us
today. Ami Capodanno is the early college coordinator at Salem High School. Ami, thanks.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
And Michelle Pierce is Salem State University's Associate Dean in the College of Arts and Sciences, oversees their early college program. Thanks for coming in and telling us about it.
Thank you so much.
And over the next few weeks, if you happen to wander outside on a clear night, you might find yourself thinking,
look, in the sky, it's a plane.
It's a bird.
It's a frog.
A frog?
No, it's not a frog. It's not any of those things. And it's not Underdog either, but it is something green.
The comet is bright, and it's got this spectacular tail that has formed behind it. That's where the green comes from. And we have a chance to see it, maybe not with our unaided eyes, but certainly with binoculars or a small telescope in the weeks ahead.
That's Kelly Beatty, senior editor for Sky and Telescope magazine, talking about the green comet that astronomers first discovered last March when it was still some 400 million miles away from the sun. And if a comet on a 50,000-year journey doesn't pique your interest, how about NASA announcing the discovery of a new planet in the habitable zone of its star? Or new images from the James Webb Telescope that are causing us to question what we think we know about the Big Bang and the beginning of our universe? With all of that on the table, we sat down with Kelly to talk about the true wonders of our galaxy and beyond.
So this is a comet that was at one point on the very fringe of the sun's gravitational grasp. So far away, it's hard to even put a number on it. But it fell toward the sun, and it's been coming, falling in for tens of thousands of years. And it already has passed its closest to the sun, a little bit farther away than Earth's orbit. So that happened on January 12th. But what's really important here is that the comet is coming its closest to Earth, and make it that much easier to see on February 1st. So this 50,000 years is how long it's taken the comet to fall inward toward the sun. It's a very slow motion process.
How do we know? How do we know how long it's taken something from the other side of the sun, right to fall?
Right. You know, it's like how do they know how far a home run's going to go? That you can calculate based on its speed and its distance from the sun. It was discovered in early March, roughly at the orbit of Jupiter, still on its way in. By that point, it had picked up a lot of speed. You take that location and the speed it's coming in, and you can figure out where it started.
And here in New England, when are we most likely to see it with binoculars or a small telescope?
You know, you could go out tonight, and I could tell you where to see it. It's going to be getting a little brighter night by night. The peak times, and where I would encourage people to do the most looking, is around the 27th or 28th of this month, because that's when this comet will be positioned in the sky very near the bowl of the Little Dipper in the north, roughly halfway up in the sky. And there's a moon in the sky as well, and it's getting brighter night by night. So this is sort of the sweet spot between the moon getting too bright and the comet being in a place where you can find it. I would encourage everyone who really is interested in looking for it to go to our website, skyandtelescope.org. The comet story is the lead story right now. There are charts there to help you find it.
So two more questions for you. One, why is the tail green? I feel like a little kid going, why is the sky blue, right? But why is the tail on this thing green? What does that?
You know, the comet itself, the solid part, the icy block that has been, you know, vaporized by the sun, is probably only a couple of miles across. Mm. But when it does that, it creates this huge cloud around it, many thousands of miles across. And within that are vaporized gases that would otherwise have been frozen. And one of them is a very primitive molecule called diatomic carbon, two carbon atoms stuck together. And when they are struck by sunlight, they fluoresce and they give off this characteristic green glow. That color only lasts for a short period of time because that molecule will get rid of that excess energy from the sun and then become neutral again. So this cloud around the comet, which is called the coma, is what's glowing green. There's a tail too, but the tail is more whitish because it's mostly dust and other kinds of gases. But the green glow is from the head of the comet, the coma. And with a dark enough sky and a large enough instrument, I would encourage people to use a telescope if they want to see the green or take a picture of it, because our eyes don't see color well at night, but the camera would definitely show it.
All right, one last question on this, then we have many other wonders to talk with you about, Kelly. All right, so I know, and later we're going to talk about the James Webb Telescope and galaxies it's seeing, you know, far, 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 far away, which means far, far, far back in time. Something like this green comet, which technically I think is called Comet C2022E3, which is not a very exciting name. Am I seeing basically it in real time, or am I seeing it passed 2 years ago? Do you understand my question?
Yeah, sure. And you know, and we'll get into this with the Webb Telescope. Astronomy and the universe are time machines.
Right.
The farther away something is, the longer it's taken that light to reach you. When the comet passes close to us, 26 million miles, it will be roughly one-third of the distance from us, from Earth to the sun. It will take that comet's light about 2 minutes to reach us.
Oh, so I really am seeing
it
now.
It really is a kind of real-time phenomenon.
So it's just a two-minute time travel.
And in fact, for those who are really dedicated about this, when you look at it one night and go out and find it the next night, it will have moved in the sky because the comet is screaming. It's now on its way out of the solar system, perhaps never to return.
Wait, would it make a noise if we were right next to it? Would we hear something?
No, okay. It doesn't go whoosh or anything like that.
It doesn't go whoosh or anything like that. Okay. All right. So as long as we're talking about the James Webb Telescope, let's pick that up. We talked with you when the first images came in back in July. And in fact, we'll put that conversation back up on our website at radioboston.org so people can hear it if they want to. But now we've got this thing we're hearing about where it is turning our conception of galaxies on its head, something about either too many galaxies or too bright. And I want to know who gets to decide how many galaxies are too many or enough. What is going on with that?
That's right. This was announced just last week at a meeting of American astronomers in Seattle. And that's where a lot of important announcements are made. So just for everyone's understanding, the Webb Telescope does not look at the universe in visible light like what our eyes see. It looks at infrared radiation. And that's important because light from the most distant objects in our universe, as it travels across space to reach us, is stretched. The wavelengths get stretched. Think slinky.
Okay.
All right? And so the wavelengths get longer. So what might have started out as visible light reaches us as infrared light. So Webb can see it.
So the only way we'd see it is if we have something like
that. That's right. Webb can see it. And you know, this notion of how far back in time can we see was... we were teased by the Hubble Space Telescope, but the Webb Telescope, one of its primary objectives is to see as far back, as close to the beginning of the universe as we can, and specifically to see what galaxies looked like back then, how soon they developed, and were they just amorphous blobs because they were combining with each other and it was, you know, just a maelstrom, or did they actually have structure? So what this result came out with last week, not only are those very earliest galaxies, we're talking a half a billion to 2 billion years after the formation of our universe, not only are there more of them, they appear to be brighter and more numerous, but they're better defined. They have shapes that, you know, our Milky Way galaxy is called a barred spiral galaxy. And remarkably, that's what Webb is showing us that far back. It runs counter to what we thought early galaxies would look like, and we're seeing more of them than our models of what the early universe would have suggested.
All right, so a couple of things there. First, you said, what, half a billion years to up to 2 billion years after the original Big Bang, basically. Just for everybody else, how far from that time are we now?
So the universe is thought to be 13.7 billion years old.
So we are talking way back.
Way, way back. And so, you know, this notion of the earliest universe, it was a white hot fireball.
Yeah.
And as time went on, it cooled and things started forming. First there were atoms, then there were molecules, then there were clouds of gas, and it wasn't completely homogeneous. Otherwise, there would be no galaxies, right? There were little pockets of higher density. And as those came together, they formed stars and then they formed galaxies. That's the sort of basic model that we're dealing with here. Astronomers thought that these galaxies would not reach this sort of state of maturity, let alone the number of them, until later in time. So we're seeing, it's like a baby is born and, you know, it's already got hair and speaking to you. You know,
okay, so
that's the notion.
We now are seeing, I mean, wow. So we are now seeing back in time, maybe 13 billion years.
Close to that, right.
We had a hypothesis about how messy the universe was going to be 13 billion years ago, and it was based on our ability to see pretty far, but not far enough, and not with the kind of light that comes from the oldest part of space history.
Because we had never seen that far behind, back in time before. We only had models of how things should look once Webb got launched.
So what else gets broken or rocked or rethought? I mean, when we make models, we are people, so then we model other things based on those models. We say, okay, well, if that's the model, then I'm going to model this, and then I'm going to model this based on that. And now the original model is wrong. So what else gets broken or rethought?
Well, exactly. And so, you know, this is the beauty of science. You come up with a hypothesis, you make an observation that either proves or disproves it, and based on that, you go back to the drawing board. And astronomers are now at the back to the drawing board stage. They have to rethink their models of the early universe to try to understand how these earliest galaxies that they're seeing managed to become so mature in such a short period of time.
And does back to the drawing board for these researchers and scientists feel bad or exciting?
Oh, it's exciting. And so one thing to bear in mind is that the Webb telescope has not seen as far back as it's capable of doing.
So there's more coming.
And so what the next step will be, all right, where was the point in the evolution, you know, a half a billion years beforehand? What did things look like back then?
How long will it take us to get information today on something that's, let's say, another half a billion years older than what we just got?
You know, those images, those observations have probably already been taken.
Unreal.
And they're just grinding out. Let's remember, the Webb telescope has been in space for more than a year now. And here's a mind-blowing fact for you.
Mind's already kind of blown.
April, we will celebrate the 33rd anniversary of the launch of the Hubble Space Telescope, which is still functioning. That's a third of a century ago.
Wow. Are you pretty excited about what's coming
excited.
Next?
I got goosebumps.
Yeah.
Goosebumps.
You're giving me goosebumps, and I'm still just learning how to think about it. All right. So, I'm torn between moving on to the last subject and asking you one more question on this. So I'm just going to feed my mind and ask you one more question on this. You said that you gave the name of the shape of our galaxy here in the Milky Way. And you said that some of these really, really old ones from like the very beginning look a lot like that.
Yes.
Should I really be keyed in on that? Does that say something like maybe there's habitable space back then or anything? Or is it just, eh?
Sure. So the Milky Way galaxy, our home galaxy, it's 100,000 light years across. It has this very mature shape, this beautiful, elegant pinwheel of stars that we see.
It's beautiful.
And it got that way because since it formed, it has been gobbling up other galaxies in its neighborhood. It is the 600-pound gorilla in the room. Okay?
Makes me kind of want to go, sorry.
And that's right. And so every time it does that, you know, it adds mass and it becomes more mature.
Okay.
This is a mature shape. The fact that we look back this far and we see these barred spiral galaxies, which is an indication of the maturity of them already, that's the mind-blowing part.
That's super helpful. I'm glad I asked that question. But now I want to ask one more, because now we've got this planet thing, right? So now we are hearing, and this is from a different piece of technology, a piece of technology called TESS, which has strong MIT ties, that, let me see if I can get this right. There is a new planet that has been discovered that is in the, what's called the habitable zone around its sun. And it's kind of Earth size, and it looks like it could have supported water or maybe could now support water
right.
at some point.
Let's start with defining the habitable zone.
Yeah.
It's the place around any given star where the temperature is just right so that water can be a liquid.
Okay.
We're lucky here on Earth. Water can be a liquid. Life depends on water, right? If we were Mars, the water would be all frozen. If we were Venus, the next planet in, it's all vaporized and it's up in its atmosphere.
So there really is only one zone around a star where that would be possible.
Think Goldilocks. Not too hot, not too cold.
Just nice. Right. Nice.
Now, not all stars are as hot as the sun. Some are hotter, some are cooler. This particular star, which has the designation TOI 700,
yes,
is about 1,000 light years away. And it is a dwarf star. It's about half the size of the sun, about half the temperature of the sun. That means that its habitable zone is going to be closer in because
it puts off less heat.
It puts off less heat.
Okay.
This TESS spacecraft has discovered now four planets in orbit around this one star, which is great. It's a little solar system out mm-hmm. there. We can't see that star from here. You have to go down to the southern hemisphere to see it. But two of the planets now, not just the one that was, and they're just lettered. It's B, C, D, okay?
Yeah. This one I think is E,
right?
B, C, D, E. T-O-I 700
A is the star itself. So yeah, B, C, D, and E are the four planets.
No, I get that. Okay.
Two of them now lie within the habitable zone of this star. The one that had been discovered before, which was a couple of years ago by TESS, is really in the sweet spot of the habitable zone, and its average temperature is about 25 degrees Fahrenheit year in and year out.
That's
on Earth,
cold.
By the way, it's 57 degrees in case it might.
It's a little cold.
All right. So it's a little cold. This newest one is on the inner edge of the habitable zone. It gets a lot more sunlight. And although the scientists who did the discovery haven't said so, I'm reading the paper and I'm thinking its average temperature is maybe around 100 degrees.
Okay.
Now, that's hot for humans, but the water is still liquid.
Yep.
We don't know that there's water on the surface. We don't even know that it's rocky. But we do know that it's roughly the size of the Earth, and that would imply that it's rocky. And so the next step, what TESS has done, it's concentrating on stars with planets that are close by, because only then do we have a prayer of a chance of studying the planets individually, picking them off as separate from the star.
Yep.
So that's the next step. And in fact, this new discovery will probably be a target for the James Webb Space Telescope.
Dun, 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 dun. All right. Last question, just briefly, Kelly. Are people looking to see if there might be life on that planet or if that planet might be able to support our life?
It's the second question that we're looking for. It turns out the gases that are common to us, carbon dioxide, water vapor, you know, methane, for example, are all very strong spectroscopically. They have a fingerprint in their spectra that is very diagnostic. And Webb Telescope and other telescopes, even here on Earth, can look at this planet. You can't even figure out you can't resolve that it's a disk, but you can analyze its atmosphere, assuming that it has one. We don't know that yet. And determine whether there's water vapor in the atmosphere, for example. And that would be really important, because if there's water vapor in the atmosphere, as we know, that's a key component for life. So we're trying to determine whether these planets are habitable, mm-hmm. not inhabited.
Kelly Beatty, senior editor of Sky and Telescope magazine. You sat down with us yesterday for that crash course on all the happenings in and around our galaxy. And we're inviting you to sit down with us. Our film series set in Boston is hitting the road. We want you to come along. We're not going far. Join us at Brookline's Coolidge Quarter Theater on Thursday, January 26th for an evening viewing of The Departed, and then stay for a conversation with esteemed panelists that I'll lead. To get tickets, you go to coolidge.org/events. That's coolidge.org/events. Set in Boston will be there on Thursday, January 26th. And that's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.